Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's and the poker coach, Joe McGowan. I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please. Brought to you by Poker Stars, Reactor Watches, and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
I am Paul Harrah's alongside Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips. We'll introduce you to the guy who took down the main event here last week in just a couple of minutes. Also joining us on the phone from Poker Coach World Headquarters in Southern California. After a two-week hiatus, welcome back to Joe McGowan. Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Paul. How are you guys doing?
Well, not too well. I come sit down here at the table, and Joe Galloway comes up to me with a box full of donuts. Did you put him up to this? What the heck is going on here?
After seeing you a few days ago, I'm in big trouble. I've stayed the same. You're looking good.
We got to explain. These guys have a weight loss prop, and Dennis has taken off quite a few pounds. And so, trying to tempt him, Joe, you're always evil in that way.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I'm 1,000 miles from him, and he's still doing it. Unbelievable.
Now, you guys saw each other in Las Vegas over the weekend after things finished up here in St. Louis. You went off and had some business meetings. Did you get to play at all while you were there?
Not really. Very little bit. From what I hear, Joe did fairly well in a couple of games out there, some cash stuff, but I wasn't able to. I was tied up with some meetings.
Where did you play, Joe?
I bounced around from the Bellagio and Aria. I tried out, Aria. There's some good 5-10 games, and there's definitely some vacation people in there playing some 2-5, and you just don't have that local kind of grinder type of guy in there. So it's a pretty good spot, and it's a fun place to play as well.
Yeah, people always say anytime a new poker room opens, that's always a good time to get in there for the first couple of months because it's going to be fairly soft games that you can take advantage of, and the pros apparently haven't discovered it yet. I had said that about the MGM Grand poker room. Mm-hmm. You go there on Friday or Saturday nights for the last year or so, and the games have been fairly soft because the local pros who are grinding things out at the Venetian or Bellagio or wherever else it is, they're not in those games. Is that what you found at Aria?
Yeah, for sure. And you just said it, the Bellagio and Venetian, great rooms, great games.
Yep.
But just you don't have that kind of vacation guy in there splashing around, and it's they were good, very good at Aria.
Yeah, I was out there. I was over at the Venetian, and it was packed as usual. They've got another one of their deep stack type tournaments going on.
Yep.
Dustin Ashby, who has the World Series of Fantasy Football,
yep,
is starting something new out at the Venetian this weekend with his Fantasy Baseball.
Oh, yeah.
And we were out there talking about that, and I walked over by the poker room, and literally the whole front of it again was stuffed with it for the tournament. The inside had table after table. These guys at Venetian are doing something right.
They are.
I'm very, very impressed with what they've been doing out there.
Really, it's a terrific room that our friend Kathy Raymond runs and her whole staff. Speaking of poker and big events and rooms full, the room in San Remo, where the EPT is taking place this week, not as full as some people might have expected because of that volcano in Iceland. And I'm wondering if it's going to affect you. Aren't you supposed to leave later this week to go to the EPT in Monte Carlo?
I am. I'm supposed to be flying out on Thursday to it. I called the airline to ask them, what my alternatives are. And they said, stay home or take this flight because every other flight is booked solid till May 1st. There's so much pushback from the people that are stranded. Some people are even trying to book 2 and 3 times, even if they lose some of their money just to get a flight. Everything is swamped. If my flight is canceled on Thursday, I will not be going to Monte Carlo, is what it basically comes down to.
Which is an event you love to go to.
I want to go.
It's
so badly.
Big finale to the European Poker Tour that Poker Stars does.
Now, that's not to say this is not going to be going on. Poker Stars has it handled. They have a group in San Remo that can basically drive over there. If need be, knowing Eastside the way is, he'll fly a corporate jet to get people over there to make sure this happens. So the event will go on. It just may go on without me.
A lot of, and I'm guessing a lot of other people from North America.
Absolutely.
A lot of pros
yeah.
who who might have busted out of the WPT event at Bellagio this week.
Yep.
Which is also going on, the big $25,000 finale to the WPT year, their championship event at Bellagio. 195 people in there. That is down. That is half of what they had last year, 380. And you played it in a couple of years ago. Weren't there something like 650 in it?
Yeah, there was over 650 in 08 when I played in it. I think I came in 108 on that one. Didn't do that well on it. But it's gone, you know, numbers have gone down every year since then.
Very interesting see what's happening in WPT and the rise of the European Poker Tour, the Latin American Poker Tour, the Asian Australian Poker Tour, and now the North American Poker Tour, which just finished up. We were talking about it a little bit last week when Bernard Lee was here. You and he had just gotten back from that event at Mohegan Sun, and you did not play in the 25K Bounty Shootout.
I had another obligation here in St. Louis.
Yeah, you had to come back for the main event here.
Absolutely.
But congratulations to Jason Mercier, another fellow Poker Stars pro, who took that event down last week. And what a 12 months this guy's had.
Oh, my God. He's hot as anybody on the circuit. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
When Daniel drew him on the heads up that you'll see. Well, you saw it this last Sunday.
Yeah, on Sunday.
Yeah. Daniel wasn't happy.
No. Jason is an aggressive and tough young player.
Yeah,
and
he'll play any two cards and play it well.
And you'll hear a lot more about him in 2010, absolutely. So last week we had the main event of the first ever World Series of Poker Circuit event here at Harrah's St. Louis. And as we were talking last week, the event was just kicking off. You didn't make it through day one. In fact, you didn't You didn't make it to the first break.
Okay, can we move on to the next subject?
Well, I didn't even play, so... nothing personal against you, but sitting here at the table with us is a man who made it to the first break and the second break and made it all the way through day number one and day number two, and at the end of day number three, turned out to be the guy who took it all down, our friend Jeff Roper. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul.
Congratulations.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you on here, and it's great to have a really good St. Louis poker player take this whole thing down. Jeff is known for playing some of the higher-stakes games here, including some of the high-stakes PLO games. And there were several guys who play with Jeff in those games who were really rooting for him because they know that you're going to put that money right back on the table here, aren't you?
They definitely came into the room and were rooting me on. I'm not sure if they were rooting for me or rooting for my money, but they were supporting me.
Well, let me give them a little words of warning. I watched you play over here when we got down to three tables and getting down. I think they played 12 places, so they're getting close to that.
Yep.
Some of the strategy you used, I could tell it from the rail what you were doing, and I was very impressed with it. Because you played fairly tight when there was the people around there. You chose your hands. You chose your position well. But then when it got close to the bubble, you kind of took over the table.
I had a big advantage with going to the bubble with the majority of the players playing to not waste the 2 days they were playing and actually cash
Correct.
In the event. And I had a fairly large chip lead on them where I could take advantage and steal some chips from them.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing of it is you did that. A lot of people talk about doing that. It's difficult to do on the table. You did it and did it very well. I sat there and watched you, and I don't like watching cards if I'm not at the table, okay, to be honest about it. I watched you for a couple of hours there, and I was very impressed.
Thanks, Dennis. Means a lot.
I want to talk about one hand that I watched you play because I was over here at Harrah's that day, that Thursday afternoon, watching you for a few hours and studying some of the other players and trying to take you aside every once in a while and say, did you see this? Did you see what that guy was doing? You know, trying to look for some tells to help you out there. And when it got down to three-handed, you were in it against Jason Moe, who is a 23-year-old poker pro. As he says, everybody has to fill out their information sheets, and that's what he said on his sheet. And Jeff is an attorney, and the other guy at the table was a chiropractor from Illinois named Gary Lambert. And you were the chip leader against these two guys, but they had both chipped up by taking out other players. And I think Gary and Jason were about even in chips, like 600,000, and you had about 800,000. When there was a very interesting hand that came up, which you and I have talked about off the air, and I'd like you to talk about it on the air if you would, if you remember how it went down. You have a very aggressive style and had been playing fairly aggressively, but you were changing gears at times. And I had never seen this young guy, Jason Moe, before. He'd never played in any of the games that we play in, and I knew Gary to be a guy who's got a lot of tournament experience, plays in some of the smaller cash games, but is mostly a tournament player. But do you know the hand that I'm talking about?
I do, Paul.
Okay, can you go into that? Because I think there's some very interesting strategy behind the decisions that you made in this hand.
Sure. I was basically heads up with Gary, who I'd been playing with most of the day before, and he was trying to cash in the event and had to play very tight to get to that point. And then by the time we were three-handed at the final table, he was playing very aggressively because he had a large chip stack and he was tired of being pushed around for the previous day, mainly by me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a small blind, he was a big blind. And I had King-Jack off suit, which isn't the best hand, but when you're playing heads up with someone, there's worse hands.
Yep.
I didn't want to play a big pot with him, so I just call from the small blind, the button folded. And he just checked from the big blind. At that point, I knew he had a very weak hand, because if he had any sort of hand, he was playing very aggressively at this point. He had position on me. He was going to play this hand aggressively if he had any two big cards. The flop comes out King 9-8 with the 9-8 of hearts, which I thought was a pretty good flop for me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very safe in that flop. I checked to him. He also checks. That furthered my belief that he had a very weak hand.
At that point, you can be sure your pair of kings is probably good.
I was very sure I was good there and thought he was going to have trouble even catching up to me.
At that point, are you still thinking I want to play a small pot against this guy, or are you now thinking, ooh, maybe I can get some chips out of him?
No, I was still wanting to play a small pot. I had a chip lead on both the other players. He had position on me. I had a very marginal hand. I didn't have a hand that was good enough to I want to play a really large pot in with, but I felt good in my position.
Mm-hmm.
What are the antes and everything at this time, the blinds?
There was about $13,000 in the pot.
Okay.
The small blind was $3,000, the big blind was $6,000.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I checked the flop. He checks behind me. There was also two hearts on the flop. At this point, I also took him off a heart draw, because if he had a heart draw there, he was playing so aggressively that at this point, he would have bet his heart draw.
Mm-hmm.
The flop comes a three of spades.
The turn.
The turn comes a three of spades. That puts two spades out there and two hearts out there.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get a little money out of him, so I bet the turn. I think I bet $15,000.
A little bit more than what's in the pot.
A little bit more, and thought I'd just take down that pot and keep my chip lead.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks for a minute and raises to 60,000 chips, mm-hmm. which was a very large raise at that point. Even though I didn't want to play a big pot, I felt I was good. I thought my King Jack was good, and I thought he was pushing me around.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he would have bet the flop if he had a good hand, and I thought he would have bet pre-flop if he had good cards.
You're pretty sure that the turn card to three of spades doesn't help him.
Right.
Unless he's got pocket threes.
Exactly. So I think for a little bit and couldn't put him on any hands and thought my King Jack was good, even though that was a very, very marginal call there that didn't leave me very many hands to beat, or really the only hand I could beat was a bluff.
Mm-hmm.
So I call, and a six of hearts hits the river, which yep. definitely didn't help my hand. I have top pair with a very mediocre kicker. And I checked to him. Again, I don't want to play a big pot, even though I think I'm good here. He thinks for a second and bets 125,000 chips, which was a very large bet.
That's almost a pot-sized bet there.
A pot-sized bet.
60. Yeah.
That bet just made no sense to me. I couldn't put on a hand that was so strong that he would need to bet that much. I could put him on a hand that beat mine, but I think if he would have came up with two bad pair there, he would have checked it, or maybe bet a very small amount. I just didn't see where his hand was so strong that he thought it was valued at $125,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for a minute, and I make the call, even though I knew the only hand there I could beat was a bluff,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he was
or
doing.
Or a weaker king.
A weaker king, but I really don't think he would have bet a no. weaker king there. I think he would have checked or maybe made a very, very small value bet. But I think he would have checked almost any medium quality hand there.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, if he had a weaker king, I think he would have bet on the flop. You know, top pair, weaker king.
Right.
I think he would have tried to get it up.
If he's got
that,
king 10.
I don't put him on a king at all there.
King 10, king 7, king deuce.
Right. My worry actually would have been that he cut like second or third pair on the flop and with a 3, because big blind could have almost anything. He's got two pair, but weak pairs.
Yeah. He's got to have 8, 3, 9, 3, one
exactly,
of those stupid hands.
Exactly, stupid thing that way on
right.
it. That would have been my worry
yeah.
on it.
That's one of those where afterwards you go, well, why didn't I bet the flop and get him right out of
yeah,
there?
Yeah.
Although maybe he doesn't go away, you know? Maybe he thinks you're being aggressive and he's got a pair and he's going to play him, and then he lucks into two pair on the turn. So anyway, you call him on the river, and?
He was bluffing, like what my read was, and thankfully, because I couldn't have beat much more.
Mm-hmm. It's always nice when it works out that way.
Now, I'm watching this from the bleachers, and I saw something that was going on there, which I'm not going to give away on the air here, but it was something that I had mentioned to Jeff earlier that I had seen Gary doing. And while this hand was going on, I was 100% sure he was weak. I didn't know if he was bluffing or not. Maybe he had one pair, but I thought to myself, if Jeff has a king here, he's good. And then I thought to myself, I hope Jeff sees this. Did you see it?
I did, Paul, and Paul and I did have some discussions on the breaks and brought some things to my attention that I didn't notice all of, and definitely much appreciated.
Yeah, but that was one of those things that as you were playing out the hand, the tell helped as well as trying to get the read on what his bets were, et cetera?
Yeah, I think you definitely have to look at mannerisms, and his mannerisms were very aggressive. And usually when you have a big hand, you're not trying to be real aggressive with your mannerisms or throwing the chips into the pot real aggressively, and that's what he did there. And a lot of times when players are standing up tall at the table and acting aggressively, they have a weak hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, before we get to the other hand I want to talk to you about, I want some reaction from the poker coach here, Joe McGowan, who's been listening to this as we've been going through this hand. Any of that sound like unsound reasoning to you? We know what the result, of course, was, Joe, but what was your reaction as we were describing the hand?
Well, in the beginning, first I should say congratulations, by the way. What a nice victory.
Thank you.
Like you played great.
Thank you.
Well, just listening to it at first, it's like, geez, in my mind I would have raised with the King-Jack just pre-flop. But as I got to listening and feeling, this player might be a little more aggressive, sometimes you got to give those guys a little bit of rope. And sometimes it's a tough spot. You want to protect your hand. Your hand might be a little vulnerable there to let a turn card come off, and maybe he can hit a funny, goofy two-pair he might bet for value. But sometimes you get to do that in a tournament. You have to sometimes gamble a little bit more and try to induce players to bluff for value, where you have a king-jack top pair, but you're not willing to really go to war with it to get those chips. So it sounds to me like you really did truly play the hand well. In general, just a general statement. If you're not against like an aggressive type player, just an average player, you're probably going to raise. Because you don't want them to flop some funny two pair and you hit a jack or a king, and then you lose a big pot. Because it's hard to fold that type of hand. Or a modest sized pot. And on the turn, you might want to protect your hand, or even after the flop with the hearts out there and protecting against the funny two pair. But in this spot, against an aggressive player, I think I would have played the same. And, again, congratulations. Sounds like you played the hand really, really well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
For him to bet the river, too, is kind of awkward, to bet into the hearts that just got there. Again, sounds like you made another good read, and he bluffed off some chips there. So, yeah, sounds good to me.
A couple of things that I liked about it. I actually, as aggressive as it was, if he'd have raised you preflop, I think that you could have re-raised him and probably taken the pot down then on it. The second thing I liked is on the turn making a bet rather than checking a second time. You want to get some money in the pot in case you catch that third king or your king jack or whatever the heck you happen to catch. You already felt you were in good shape. You need money in the pot so that you can actually get something sizable. If perhaps he had jack high and couldn't put you on the king, jack comes on the turn, you got two pair, or the river, boom, who knows what. I'm just throwing out possibilities. If you have nothing in it, that's why if I have a hard draw or a straight draw or something and nobody else is betting anything, a lot of times on the turn, I will make a bet out there to get some money in the pot so that you have something to actually, then you can make a sizable bet on the river and do it.
I think I bet 15,000 on the turn, mm-hmm, and was raised to 60,000.
Yeah, I know. That was the shocker when he came back over the top.
Right.
And you're sitting there going, I know I've got the best hand. Where the heck did this come from?
Right.
Do you think when he bet the river, when the six of hearts came, putting three hearts out there, he's just basically trying to represent hearts, but it's a story he can't sell because he didn't bet the flop?
I'm not sure what his thought process there, but what you said there was a story he couldn't sell. I think that's very accurate. I just could not put him on a hand. And I thought there, and I thought of all the hands that he could have, and I couldn't make any hand make sense from the beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get to that point, you have to call someone down. If you can't put him on a hand and they make an extremely large bet, maybe he lucked into some kind of odd straight or something like that, and I'm going to lose it every now and then. But I think when you once you go through that thought process and you just can't put them on anything, it's you get some value there by calling.
That would have been sick if you turned over 10-7 and that six on the river gave him the straight.
Yeah,
just sick.
Yeah,
it also sounds like, you know, he maybe, this is a funny term, but maybe he didn't really bluff the river, although he did. It was probably, you know, more of a desperate attempt to win the pot.
That's what I was going to go with.
You know, he's just firing pretty big in there and holding on and hoping you don't have a big hand, you know, the way the hand was being played.
And I think that's what I foresaw a little bit by wanting to play a small pot. You know, I was the chip leader. I didn't have position here. I knew I was going against someone who was going to play the hand extremely aggressively.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure and if I had a marginal hand, all my chips didn't get in there. And, I was fearful that how it played out was how it was going to play out and wanted to keep the pot a little small.
This is the final table on 5-9 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com. And we're talking with Jeff Roper, who last week took down the main event of the World Series of Poker circuit event here in St. Louis at Harrah's Casino. And Jeff is known as a fairly loose, aggressive player in all of the cash games here in town. Aggression has always been part of your game, as all of the local players here know. And as we pointed out before, you had been using it to great benefit throughout the 3 days that it took to take this down. That's why many of us laughed when we heard about the last hand, because for Jeff Roper to win a tournament with pocket aces was about as far from what any of us expected as you could possibly get.
I'd give him some credit. I granted, if you'd have won it with a 9-3, I would have believed it. But, you know, come on now, be nice.
But let's talk about the last hand, because, you know, people say, oh, pocket aces, those are easy to play. Not necessarily, and particularly if you want to get a lot of chips out of your opponent in a heads-up situation, which is what you were at that point. Gary Lambert had been eliminated in third place. You're heads-up against Jason Moe, this young pro who plays a lot online, I'm guessing. And you look down at pocket aces. Where was the button? Were you a large blind, small blind? What happened there?
I was a small blind on the button.
Okay, so you look down at pocket aces, and you obviously raise.
I do raise, although when we were playing heads up, we probably played heads up 100 or 200 hands over
couple
the two hours. I literally raised every time I was on the button. Mm-hmm. If I looked down and saw 7-deuce, I still raised because I wanted to disguise if I ever got a hand like aces. And mm-hmm. he would know if I had 7-deuce or aces.
Yep.
And we would get to play the large pots when I get to act second.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you raise on the button. What does he do?
I raise to 30,000. He re-raises me, which he did about 10% of the time. Since I was raising every time, he would have to re-raise me every once in a while because I could have some really bad hands when I would raise. And he re-raised to 90,000.
Okay. So are you thinking to yourself, okay, this is the perfect situation. He has a hand here. Or are you thinking, you know, what is your thought process at that point?
Yeah, that actually is my first thought. The first thing I thought was, what do I do now? Because I'm giving away my hand if I re-raise him back. And over the 2 hours that we played, I never re-raised him once. So
you had raised on the button a lot. He had re-raised, three-bet you maybe about 10% of the time. And on those three-bet opportunities, you had either called or mucked, but you would never four-bet him.
That's correct.
Okay, so what do you do?
Well, I have to think for here a little bit. You know, I have a pretty good chip lead on him. I know if I re-raise him here, he's going to muck. And if you know, if I was in his shoes and I would get fourth bet for the first time in 2 hours, there's only one or two hands I'd play. And I wanted to get all the chips in here, but I didn't want him to insta-muck his hand. Mm-hmm. So I think for a while, but then I think, well, I have a pretty good chip lead here. If he wants to fold the 100,000, that puts him in an even weaker position. And I'm still in good shape to win the tournament. So I kind of did something in the middle, and I basically min-raised him to 190,
mm-hmm.
Which I think maybe put him in a little tough spot to read my hand. Was he going to fold for 100,000 chips, or was at that point was he committed to putting in all his chips?
Mm-hmm.
And he instant went all in.
The perfect situation. The scenario every poker player dreams of.
That was a good feeling. So I think my chips got in there before his.
And the good part of the story is, unlike everybody else's bad beat stories, the aces held up.
They did.
Yeah.
They did.
And you ended up winning it. Well, nicely played. A terrific strategy throughout, and you deserved it. Jeff won 170,000 and change, plus a seat to the main event of the World Series of Poker this summer at the Rio. And Jeff and I had talked about that, and he said, well, you know, I probably am going to go out and play the main event. Now it's definite, isn't it?
I'm all signed up.
Did you pick a day yet that you're going to play?
I believe I'm going to start July 8th, which is the last day.
The last day of it.
Yeah. Right, how about yourself, Dennis?
Probably ahead of that. I'll probably play the 7th or the 6th on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I look forward to seeing you out there.
We'll be out there. We'll either celebrate or commiserate. I don't know. Hopefully the celebrate part of it.
I'll be in the cash game sweating you guys just like I did last year.
All right.
Jeff Roper, the first ever champion of the World Series of Poker circuit event here in St. Louis, winner of the main event last week. Congratulations again.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show.
We take a quick break here, and then we come back, and the poker coach, Joe McGowan, has a piece that he's got ready to go here on cash game players who don't have a lot of tournament experience, who want to get into the game and make that shift from just playing cash to tournament action. A quick reminder about our new Final Table merchandise, which we debuted here over the 2 weeks of the WSOPC here at Harrah's St. Louis. We had great response to our sweatshirts and t-shirts and wind shirts and some Cuba Vera shirts, which I think we're sold out of now. We also had hats in all different styles. If you did not get one while you were here, you can go to Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. You click on the shop button and you'll be able to get all the merchandise that's there. We also do have some leftover St. Louis special shirts that we're going to be putting on the website, and you'll be able to get those if you were here and didn't buy one while you were here. This will be your last chance to pick those up. Once again, the Final Table merchandise is available on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. That's the same place where you find the podcasts every week of this show, The Final Table, on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Whether you play in a home game or online or in the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis, this is the radio show for you. It's The Final Table with Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's on 590 The Fan, KFNS.
Welcome back to the show here in the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis. We're happy to have you aboard. I am Paul Harrah's. Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips is here with me. And the poker coach, Joe McGowan, who has been absent the past couple of weeks, is back with us now and has been kind of itching to talk about an issue that, well, frankly, relates to our previous guest, Jeff Roper, who's only played a few tournaments in his life, a pretty good cash game player, turned out to be the winner of the main event of the World Series of Poker circuit event here in St. Louis. And there are lots of other cash players who would love to follow in his footsteps, both at regional events and, of course, at the World Series of Poker, which is starting up just 6 weeks away.
I know. It's
at
amazing.
At the Rio. So, Joe, let's talk a little bit about the people who regularly play in cash games who want to turn into tournament players or try to mix up their game and add tournaments to the mix.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a lot of players like that. Everybody typically plays cash first and then takes a shot in tournaments. You know, it's very rare you get a guy that learns how to play in tournaments. It just doesn't happen. When you play in a tournament and you look down at pocket jacks during the middle of the tournament and without a doubt in the later stages of the tournament, I mean, that's like gold. You look down at pocket jacks in a cash game, I mean, you're not even thinking about going to battle. At least I'm not. I mean, hardly anybody would be. So just the different, you know, the strength of the hands and the value of the big pairs and middle pairs, you know, you get in the late stages of the tournament and you're starting to get short stacked and you look down at pocket eights, I mean, you're willing to go all in no problem typically. You know, and again, a cash game, you have X amount of dollars left. You're maybe not having a great night, but you might have $1,200 in front of you. That $1,200 is going to spend fine tomorrow. You can pick up and leave and fold those eights, you know, if it seems like a somewhat of a risky spot. I'd say knowing the breaking order of the tournament tables, a lot of cash game players, they may be unaware of that there even is a breaking order. And many players, when they're relatively new and used to playing cash, they'll come and not realize the importance of that. If you've been at the table for X amount of hours in a tournament and you've built up a certain reputation, maybe you've played relatively tight because you're not used to the tournaments, and you know your table is going to break in likely about an hour or so, you know, that's a great time to maybe run a couple of bluffs. If that situation presents itself, you might push that a little bit, knowing that your table is going to break and you're going to stand to lose that reputation that may or may not have come, you know, on purpose. It may be you just kept looking down at 7-4 and Jack 5 and these different hands, you've created a tight image, but you're typically a little bit more loose than that, and now you can run a few bluffs before this table breaks. So know the break and order. It's usually posted on the TV.
Yep. You know, let's talk about
the bottom.
Let's talk about this notion of table image and table breaking for just a moment, because the event a couple of weeks ago, the 560 buy-in event that I made the final table of and ended up finishing fifth, I was at one of the tables that everybody else was breaking to. I sat down in seat two at that table and did not get out of that seat for 14 straight hours. Everybody else at my table eventually busted out, many of them as my victims or victims of other people. There was only one guy left at the table who was there with me from the very beginning of the day. And what was great about that for me was when you move to a whole new table and you're sitting there with nine or eight other players, and you haven't played with them for a while, but they've played with each other, you've got to sit down and you've got to learn how they play. You've got to watch for their tells. You've got to see how they bet. You've got to see what kind of hands they play. And you've got to learn them all very quickly, eight or nine at a time. When you're sitting at a table that gets broken two, like I was that day, you're only going to have to learn one, maybe two new players at a time. And the ones who have been with you for a long time, you're fully confident of what their image is, and they're fully confident of what your image is, and so you know how each other plays. And you have a great advantage on those who have moved to your table where you may not know how they play, but they're coming to your table. And they're going to be wondering, why is this guy still sitting here, if in fact he has been sitting here for a long time? What's his image at this table? And they've got to learn you and everybody else at the table at the same time. They have the tougher task of learning eight or nine different people, while you only have to learn one or two at a time.
That's a very good point. I can even take it kind of a step further on that. You've been playing, and you've had rotten hands, like Joe was saying here. Your table gets bust. You come to it. You sit down. You get your 9-8 of clubs. You decide to play it, or you finally get another hand, and you play three of the first four hands for whatever reasons on it. You've got to realize it's a new table. They've only seen you here for four hands.
Mm-hmm.
They don't realize you just folded for two straight hours, okay? And you've got to realize what your table image is at that table on it.
Yep.
It's a huge difference, and you've got to be able to instantly do it. I found myself a couple of times, and I'm sure everybody else has, you think you have this table image, you're going to portray it. The only guy that calls you is the one that just got moved to your table, you know, one round ago. He doesn't know how you've been playing.
Right.
Your table image isn't impressed into his mind. It's worthless to try to utilize that.
Right.
You've got to realize, oh, dang, the wrong guy called me. That's not going to work. You know, that type of thing. So it does make a huge difference in these tournaments.
And this goes back to something we discussed a couple of months ago when we played at the NAPT at the Venetian, and I was sitting at a table with Kathy Liebert and a bunch of young, aggressive pros, and there was an empty seat there for 4 hours that, of course, later turned out to be filled by Phil Hellmuth.
Yeah.
And Phil Hellmuth came and sat down in that chair and lasted 90 minutes before going bust. And as he left, I commented to Kathy, well, that's 4 hours of not studying the table that didn't pay off for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he loves to do that. He loves to be the guy who makes that entrance and have that image of being the guy who doesn't have to be there for the first few rounds. But that can really work against you when you don't know who's at your table and what they're doing.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. There is not that much difference between a top player and a 50th and the 100th and the 500th when you go to some of these tournaments. There is a difference in it, but it's very small. Anything you can do to improve your status, you know, if it's being there during, you know, all the hands instead of getting up and leaving for 20 minutes, if it's not showing up to the third level, if it's, you know, flirting with the waitress instead of paying attention to somebody beside you, I don't know, you name it.
Yep.
You've got to take advantage of all these little things because they add up a huge amount.
Yep, that's a great point to think about, Joe.
Okay.
And by the way, one other thing I got to mention about Phil Hellmuth. He tweeted a couple of days ago about what his World Series of Poker main event entrance is going to be this year.
Do we really care?
Well, you remember last year he did the ridiculous thing where he came in like a Roman god, carried in like Caesar, and the women around him throwing rose petals in his path.
Sitting there at one of the other tables, and the ridicule he got from the fellow poker players for that. Was just, I wish I'd had a tape of that and put that on the air.
Here's what he tweeted just a couple of days ago. My WSOP entrance this year is as an MMA fighter wearing gold or black robe with hood up, now shooting prelim video in MMA cage in Southern California. To which I almost vomited just thinking about this. But here's the reason I tell you this, because Daniel Negreanu replied almost instantly in his own tweet. Please say you're going to wear a shirt. Your tiny nipples and moobs have been on ESPN far too much already.
It reminds me of Manute Bol when he went in that like celebrity fighting thing. You know, like, I don't know if he thinks he's going to scare people the right way.
Right.
I don't know what his deal is there.
Absolutely. We've got to take a quick break. Then we'll come back with more of the poker coach, Joe McGowan, and his tips for cash game players moving into tournaments as the final table continues live on 5-9 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on thechipleader.com.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, the only show in St. Louis with a poker millionaire. That's Dennis Phillips and his co-host Paul Harris on 590 The Fan KFNS.
This is The Final Table, the weekly poker show from Harrah's St. Louis. I am Paul Harris, sitting aside Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips. And the poker coach, Joe McGowan, has more tips for you after a quick word about one of our sponsors, and that is PokerStars, the website where you can play against pros like Dennis.
And we've talked about this earlier in the show. It's just unbelievable what you can do. You go to PokerStars.net, you can qualify for free, and you can play anywhere in the world. We mentioned San Remo, where it's going on right now. We mentioned Monte Carlo, where it's going to start up at the end of this week. Whatever, if it's an NAPT, an LAPT, an EPT, an APT, all of these things from around the world, it's just unbelievable. Last year for the WSOP, what Jeff just got a seat to, PokerStars qualified 2,000 people to go out there online. I'm telling you, it's the world's largest poker site. It's free to download and play. It's award-winning. It's a 24/7 support for it. It is the best software. It is the best game selection. You've got to go to PokerStars.net, pick up your game, get a little bit better at it, play wherever you want, free trips around the world. What more could you ask for? Unbelievable.
Download that software and play on PokerStars.net. Now let's get back to the poker coach, Joe McGowan, who's talking about tips for you if you're a cash game player who's never played in tournaments. Maybe you qualify for one of these things on PokerStars.net and you get to go there and you're not familiar with what's around you when it comes to strategy. What else do you have for us, Joe?
Sure, Paul. Well, I think in tournaments, you know, there's a whole lot more gamble than typically in cash games because you have to. I mean, if you make a big raise and there's so much in the pot and you only have so much left, you might have pocket eights and the flop might even come two overcards. And normally in a cash game, you may not make a continuation bet and commit yourself, but in a tournament, you know, a player might have to push all in there and just hope and pray the other person doesn't have anything and didn't connect. And maybe they had a smaller pair or, you know, two big cards that missed the two overcards. So in general, I feel there's a lot more gamble because the blinds are going up. You know, everybody's gaining chips. You can't just hover and stay and just kind of conserve your stack like a cash game. There's no sense of urgency really in a cash game where the blinds aren't going up. So in general, there's a lot more gamble in tournaments. So you have to know how to adjust your play accordingly. And knowing what the blind levels are when you start the tournament, if I jump back a little bit, you know, the blind levels of the tournaments, is it going to be two-hour levels like the main event is, or is it going to be 20-minute levels, half-hour levels? Where are you going to be if you play relatively tight in just 4 hours? Are you going to be super short-stacked, or you can kick back and wait and pick up tells and reads and kind of relax, and in 4 hours you're going to be in pretty good shape if you hardly play a hand? So that can, you know, a cash game player may not look at something like that and not realize come 4 hours later, whoa, I got to start looking for a hand. All of a sudden, I'm short. You know, I really haven't had a hand so far, but now they're really forced to play a bad hand. So knowing that, I think, is important.
Yeah. By the way, when it comes to blind levels, one of the things that was interesting about the circuit event here, the main event that Jeff won, was by the time they got to day three, their chip stacks were still so large compared to the blind levels. At one point, Jeff had 600,000 in chips, and the blinds were 3,000 and 6,000.
Absolutely different than most tournaments. I've never seen a 75-50 round that we had here on it, some of the others. I don't mind that at all, because the more play we have, the more I think that the skill level comes out.
When the rounds are 60, 70, or I think by that time they were 80 minutes long, and you're playing with 100 big blinds, well, that's like playing a great deep stack cash game.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I love that on it. And Joe's brings up a very, very good point. There are some people, when you sit down at a cash game, you just know how they're going to play, and they're only going to play premium hands. They're going to try and grind it out. They're going to try and get their whatever amount they have in their mind on it and go. The people that do the hit and run, they'll sit down, right. They'll try and catch a hand, they'll double up, they'll get up and they'll leave. Can't do that in a tournament. got to play it different. Yep. There's a huge difference between tournament play and cash play.
That's another great point, Joe. Go ahead.
The other thing, you know, and there's many more that I'll try to squeeze in here, but one of the other things that you need to either be aware of or know for yourself, when it gets in the later stages of the tournament and if you happen to get short, what types of hands to push with. If you're not as experienced, you might look down to like an ace-four, an ace-deuce, any ace, a weak ace, and just push all in from, say, middle position or even up front. And that's a pretty big mistake. And I think a cash game player without a lot of tournament experience may not realize that. And the reason is the type of hands, the range of hands that are going to call your all-in, even though you're relatively short, is going to be any big ace that has you completely dominated. Any middle ace may happen to call you if they're in the blinds without other people acting behind them, which you're completely dominated. And then any pair, and it's not going to be a pair of fours or fives. It's going to be sixes, sevens, eights, and, of course, larger than that. So you're going to be completely dominated by anything that's going to call you with any ace. So the players that don't have as much experience, they look down, oh, I have an ace. I'm all in. You know, that's a mistake. I'd rather actually push in with a hand like 9-10. As crazy as that might sound to someone that doesn't have a lot of experience in tournaments, and for people that do have a lot of experience in tournaments, I would hope that that wouldn't sound crazy to them. But the 9-10, it's a much better hand to push with because the range of hands, again, that now that calls you, you're going to be in great shape against the pocket sixes, sevens, eights. Obviously, you're in trouble if a guy wakes up to aces, kings, or queens anyway. No matter what you push with, you're in big trouble. But it's going to play well against the small to mid-pocket pairs. And then it's going to play well against the hand like the ace-jack suited or, you know, ace-queen that happens to call you. At least you have two live cards and you're not dominated with the weak ace and you're a huge, huge dog. So that's one thing that, to be aware of and to use for yourself, but to also know that other players may be thinking like this, so it might affect how you play and what hands you call with or what hands you push with when these situations tend to come up.
Very interesting. And you see people doing that a lot. They'll move in. They see any ace, ace-deuce, ace-three, ace-four, and they'll move in. And any hand that's going to call you in that situation, you're at best going to be a slight favorite.
Yeah, exactly. What Joe's got here on the analysis is exactly right. You're trying to get it in there where, at worst, you're a 2-to-1 underdog on it. You've still got a 30-35% minimum to win this thing on it. You push in there with that ace rag, and the guy's got so many hands where you're only like a 20% favorite to win it. It's in very few hands that you are, you know, even a 50-50 or whatever. 9-10, you're a 50-50 somewhat, if or 8 and below on it. Mm-hmm. This guy calls you with an ace rag. You're still in good shape, even if he's got two overcards, you know. So you're what? You're a 2-to-1 underdog? Not bad.
Yeah, pretty good. All right, we have time for one more tip, Joe. What do you got?
Well, let's see if I can squeeze in two quick ones. Sorry, Paul.
Okay.
Math and hand ranges and, like, what percentage of gain the player is going to benefit from by maybe making a move in late position, it's much more important in a tournament than it is in a cash game. You're not going to think what percentage of game this guy's trying to steal my 10, 20 blinds in a cash game, but you might have to think of that in the tournament. Tournament-wise, if I'm on the button, it's been unopened, unraised, nobody's come in at all, and I look down at two sixes, it's well worth it for me to try to raise and steal the blinds and antes because there's so much in there typically. Cash game-wise, if I look down at twos, threes, fours, fives, and sixes, I might just call on the button hoping to hit a set because I don't want to win if I'm playing 10, 20, or 5, 10. I don't want to win $15. I want to win the guy's $6,500 he has in front of him, real cash money, spike a set, hope that he hits a funny two-pair or top pair and gets married to it or misplays his hand. So it plays very differently for what's in the pot, what's at stake. Tournament chips are so much more valuable than cash game tips. And maybe we can revisit this topic down the road because there's probably another 10 or 15 that we could have got to. But there's at least a few to get people started with from today.
Great stuff from the poker coach, Joe McGowan. Thank you very much, Joe. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, guys. See you, Dennis.
All right. Take care, Joe.
Joe's segment today is brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance, the nonprofit membership organization that we're members of and you should be a member of, too. Whether you play online or offline, in home games or charity events, you should be supporting the game that we all love, the Poker Players Alliance. They are fighting for us on Capitol Hill, trying to get legislation passed this year, trying to re-delay the implementation of the UIGEA and many other things that they are fighting for in courthouses in this country as well. We tell you stories virtually every month about some poor guys who are sitting in a home game and the cops busted down the door and told them to knock it off just because somebody was buying everybody sandwiches and beers for the night and they thought they were going to have fun in somebody's basement with a few dollars on the table. There's no reason for government to be involved in stopping your recreational play that way, and that's what the Poker Players Alliance is fighting for. So it's the small guy as well as the big guy, but we can only do it with members like you. It costs just $20 to join. Go to the website for the Poker Players Alliance, theppa.org, and we'll be happy to call you fellow members of the PPA. Now some news we have to get to towards the end of the show here. First of all, we had Jennifer Harmon on a couple of weeks ago. Our most downloaded podcast ever, by the
way.
Sweet. Jennifer doesn't do a lot of interviews, and we had a great time talking to her, and a lot of people wanted to hear what she had to say. If you missed that show, you can still find that podcast on Dennis's website, theshipleader.com. But while she was on with us, she was, as she put it, begging for votes for the Tournament of Champions.
Yep.
This is an event that's going to take place during the World Series of Poker. June 27th is the date at the Rio. It's a free roll for 20 to vote on who will be there. And I'm happy to tell you that as of today, Jennifer's in the top 20.
Yeah, but vote for Jennifer, guys.
There are a lot of people who are in there who are certainly worthy of your votes. I'll tell you, the World Series of Poker released their top 20. This is an alphabetical order, not in order of rank, although I would think that if you would ask people, the number one guy would be number one anyway, and that's Doyle Brunson.
Yeah.
And by the way, I just finished reading his autobiography, The Godfather of Poker. What a great book.
Hmm.
Reading all about his travails on the road in the early days of poker, long before Las Vegas had turned into the poker haven, long before you could go to pretty much any community in America and play poker, he was on the road with Amarillo Slim and Sailor Roberts in situations where, quite often, guns were drawn, people were killed, money was hijacked, and to have lived through that and be able to tell the tales of that and the early days in Las Vegas and the beginnings of the World Series of Poker and his friendship with Jack Binion and Benny Binion and all the rest. Great, great book. I strongly recommend. So Doyle is on the list here. Here's the rest of the 20 as of today. Voting goes on, by the way, for two more months. But as of today, if this were the final vote, you'd have Doyle Brunson, Johnny Chan, TJ Cloutier, Alan Cunningham, Antonio Esfandiari, Sammy Farha, Chris Ferguson, Barry Greenstein, Joe Hashem, Jennifer Harmon, Dan Harrington, Phil Hellmuth, Phil Ivey, John Juanda, Howard Lederer, Daniel Negreanu, Scotty Wynn, Greg Raymer, Huck Seed, and Eric Seidel. That's 20 guys I don't want to play poker against. Men and women.
There's a little bit of gold in there, too. Just a few bracelets in there.
Just a little
Just
bit.
Just a few.
Anybody in there who we could argue with?
You can always find an argument. You know, let me tell you, the poker players can always find an argument, but it's going to be hard to do that. They might find some that they felt are left out.
Yes.
They should be in there, but the problem is placing them in eliminates one of these 20. That's what's going to be the hard part.
Those 20 will join automatic qualifiers, Annie Duke, Mike Matisau, and Mike Sexton, all of whom have taken down Tournament of Champions
right.
in the past, plus the reigning champions of the World Series of Poker, Joe Catta, mm-hmm. and the WSOP Europe, Barry Shulman. They get an automatic invite
right.
as well. Plus, there'll be two sponsor exemptions. I don't know what that means. But that'll take place on June 27th, mm-hmm. a free roll for $1 million on the line, including $500,000 to the winner. Speaking of Joe Catta, a documentary about him showed up on YouTube. Apparently, he had a documentary crew following him around last year. Originally, it was supposed to be a documentary about five guys from Michigan who loved playing poker and were going off to the series. Talk about lucking into something. These documentarians lucked into the guy who took down the main event.
I was there. I was at the Palazzo with him afterwards. I went to New York when he did the Letterman. And, yes, everywhere we went was a camera crew. You couldn't climb into a car. You couldn't do anything. They were trying to film everything in the world on this and then cut it down on this documentary. So it'll be interesting.
I'm told that they are still trying to sell it to a couple of TV outlets.
Okay.
And the preview of it showed up on YouTube. And if you want to see it, it's called Sixth Street, Life After the River. Mm-hmm. So you can go see what Joe has there. Mm-hmm. And finally, Hooters Casino in Las Vegas may have to close because they're not making enough money.
What?
And I'll just say the one thing that always occurred to me every time I drove past that in Las Vegas, is there anywhere in the world where Hooters is more redundant than Las Vegas? You know? I mean, I don't think anybody is running over there to see the women in their tight shirts and short pants when there are strippers on poles in a truck going down the street.
Yeah. Okay. And unbelievable.
Yeah. So that's our show for this week. Next week, Paul Wasika, who finished second to Jamie Gold in the World Series of Poker back in 2006 will be our guest. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'll be reporting in live from Monte Carlo if you can get through the volcano.
Well, we'll see. I'd just as soon they cancel the flight rather than me crash the flight. So I will obey whatever they do. But, yes, I would love to be in Monte Carlo.
Well, good luck. We'll talk to you next week on the phone or perhaps here in person. If you've got questions for us, email them to DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. And find our podcast anytime on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, where you can also find our Final Table merchandise. For the poker coach, Joe McGowan, and Dennis Phillips, and the WSOPC champion here in St. Louis, Jeff Roper, I'm Paul Harris. Thanks for listening. This is the Final Table on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.